I'm Norman Gilliland. Welcome to the Midday for a Friday. Tonight at Farley's House of Pianos in Madison, Ryan McCullough will be playing the last three of the 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. That's tonight at 8 o'clock, and he's here. Welcome. Welcome to the Midday.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You were playing in New York just yesterday, right?
Yeah, at Cornell University, which is where I'm based. I was doing this recital in a really beautiful chapel space there on campus. Sang really just a wonderful, beautiful sound in this space, and it was sort of racing against the clock to beat a clock tower.
Literally against the clock.
Racing against their clock, which I think was not exactly the right time also, as I was told, so I had to start early.
Did you make it?
I did, yeah, barely. I made it to the sort of crashing finish of Opus 110 just as they started. So it was, I could hear them playing as I finished the piece.
As you finished it, you can't really, as an artist, you can't really speed up your playing, can you?
No, I mean, I might sometimes. I don't mean to, but, you know, pianists love to rush. So that's...
Some of them do.
Yeah.
And so now you're on the faculty at Cornell?
I'm there as a fellow. They have this very interesting kind of experimental program there for pianists interested in contemporary music. They've always had performance practice there with Malcolm Bilson.
Oh, sure. Long known as a forte pianist.
Yeah. They have a really wonderful collection of period instruments, forte pianos, clavichords, harpsichords, and it's almost a sort of little black market. There are always instruments coming and going. Also organ, that's a big thing there. So they always had performance practice, and it was usually in 18th and 19th century music. But in the last few years, they just decided to, as they described it, get with the times and add 20th and 21st century music to that as well.
Is it harder to draw an audience for the late 20th? Well, let's say mid 20th century music on. Is it harder to draw an audience because people just don't know what it is, what to expect?
I think in many ways you end up drawing from a different demographic for that very reason, because they want to go see something that they're not expecting. I think there's often a sort of a built-in fear of contemporary music in the established classical music world, which partly just comes from, you know, musical cultural conflicts that have, you know, developed over the 20th century as schisms form between various different factions of, you know, music should be this way or music should be this way.
That's always been with us, hasn't it?
And I was hearing you talk about Mendelssohn's description of Berlioz earlier. I thought that was quite apropos, actually. The caterwauling. That sort of sounds like what someone might describe, you know, contemporary music now as. So really things haven't changed very much.
Isn't that interesting? Yes, he was talking about the Frank Juge overture, which I think to most of us today would sound just fine.
Right,
it's
I know.
Hard to know what Mendelssohn's objections were.
Even the Rite of Spring starts to seem like, you know, an old war horse now.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's being performed regularly now. But even that, you know, you think, oh yeah, people were rioting to this, and now it just sounds like a, you know, really great film score.
Yeah, I don't think it would cause too many riots today.
Yeah.
What kind of reactions do you get, though? I mean, first let's talk about that younger, that different demographic that you referred to for contemporary music, and I'm assuming it's a younger one.
Yeah, I think that's often the case, but not necessarily younger. I think it's quite diverse. I've just started getting into the electronic music world, which was sort of, the jumping off point for that was a few years ago with this recording that I brought you. But more recently through, you know, the actual creation of fixed media and live processing, and that was in a school setting. But you do find that people have this sort of inherent fascination with just raw sound. And I went to a workshop that was on building your own synthesizer. And it was a free event held in Ithaca by one of the postdoc composers from Cornell. And he was teaching everyone how to build a little synthesizer with a small little oscillator and a little amplifier and a tiny speaker. And you know, it's basically a crash course on circuitry, but the sure. moment that everyone discovered how they could turn them on, once they had built the thing and you figured out how to connect the power source to the speaker, the room just filled with this buzzing cacophony and everyone's having a fantastic time. And, you know, you might think that this is, you know, very kind of ugly sounds. It's very rough. Mm-hmm. But there's an inherent fascination and curiosity for the physical sensation of sound, which I think everybody has apart from their musical acculturation. And of course, we're all acculturated somehow musically. Like, you know, I like Beethoven or I like Mendelssohn or whatever our likes are. But I think when people are able to forget that and just hear sound for sound's sake, you start to find this little child in a sandbox playing with mud mentality that I think everybody has.
Right. And so where do you say, though, this is artistry versus this is raw sound?
I know, that's the question. I mean, that's something people have been saying about new music since the 18th century. It's like, well, this is just noise.
Right.
But how you define noise really determines how you define art. You know, I mean, noise is just... The literal definition of noise is all frequencies sounding at once, like white noise white on your noise, on your television. Mm-hmm. But noise is generally a sound that you don't want to hear. So technically, that could be Beethoven's Fifth sounding at 5 a.m. I don't want to hear it. So technically, it's noise.
Context, yeah. Well, context has a lot to do with it, doesn't it?
Yes.
Where are you when you're hearing this?
Yeah, exactly.
And what do you have to do, if anything, to prepare not just the instrument but the audience for what they're about to hear? If they have no expectation, if they're going in to hear, you know, Beethoven's Fifth, they mm-hmm. have a pretty good idea. Almost everybody would have a pretty good idea yeah. what to expect. But if we're talking about something that no audience has ever heard before, do they need preparation, or do you just say, come in with an open mind and see what you get?
Yeah. I mean, I know that's often a big question, and, you know, especially for composers when they're writing program notes for their pieces, like, you know, what do you say about your piece? So to, you know, elucidate the experience to your listeners so they don't feel lost, or do you, you know, maybe you want them to feel lost. I mean, imagine people hearing Beethoven's Fifth for the first time. I mean, that on a, you know, what was that? That famous December concert.
Yes, where December 22nd, 1808. Yeah.
The Fifth, the Sixth, the Fourth Concerto.
Choral Fantasy,
which in and of itself is a crazy idea, in addition just to being a crazy piece.
Yeah, you know, just recently I discovered or rediscovered his concept for that. It was to incorporate in a finale, namely the Choral Fantasy, all the elements of the concert that had come before. That's why it's such a strange hybrid
yeah.
to us today. And yes, people did think, wow, this is pretty out there.
And at the time, the notion of the fantasy as a sort of musical genre was that it was something for an individual to experience on their own by themselves. And it was not really a concert piece. It was meant for you to be at home playing on your clavichord quietly. And so for Beethoven to bring the fantasy, which is, you know, the first 5 minutes of the piece, just him fantasizing, to a concert stage, which then is followed by, you know, I forget how many orchestral variations and then a big choir showdown, is such a weird and unexpected and somewhat shocking combination of audience expectation and genre expectation. And so how could Beethoven have prepared the audience for what they were about to hear? There's really no way other than to just hear it.
And so he had some handicaps there too that we could not have planned. It was a very cold theater. And
yeah.
the musicians were all burned out from all these rehearsals. And,
right.
And it was also... He could have controlled this, but this seemed to be a problem with Beethoven, a very long concert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so by the time you get to the end of the Choral Fantasy, they're cold, they're burned out, the performers are kind of burned out, and it's like...
Yeah, I understand they had to start the piece over, too.
Yeah.
I remember someone telling me that.
Yeah, like,
broke down. That sounds like... Sounds about right.
But, well, and just the Beethoven Fifth, you know.
Yeah.
You mentioned how strange that would sound to people then, and Goethe was one. Mendelssohn, the aforementioned Mendelssohn, played it for him on the piano, and Goethe yeah. said, "Oh, how wild, and how it must bring the whole hall down if all these whole orchestra is playing it." So yeah, it was all new music, of course.
Yeah, and I love that about new music. It now is that in a way it's sort of a recreation of what I imagine it might have felt to hear some of these great works that we now love and revere and know inside and out. I mean, I probably heard, I can't remember the first time I would have heard Beethoven's Fifth, and I probably heard the disco version at some point. And, you know, it's our conception of a piece is so deep and kind of ruined by so many cultural associations
yeah.
that it's really nice to imagine what it might have felt to be in those seats at that time without any prior experience.
When it was new music.
So experimental music and, you know, just new music generally appeals to me in that sense, because there is no starting point and there's something really exciting about that. And I feel like I listen differently, and I think perhaps listen better than I would if I was hearing something I knew very well.
Yeah, that would seem inevitable. I'm going to guess that you really benefit, though, from this combination of activities, which is to say playing a lot of Beethoven, and you have quite an extensive list, no pun intended, of romantic composers, et cetera, at the same time that you're doing this totally new music.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have that balance. And I think composers in any era have tried to find that balance. I mean, you know, Beethoven revered the composers who came before him, which would have been Bach and all of his sons. And certainly he would have been aware of other composers at his time, like Hummel.
Yes.
So, and certainly Liszt knew about Beethoven, but, you know, Liszt was also performing his own work, so there's always been this balance of new and old, and that's sort of where you are culturally at any given point anyway.
Well, shall we hear some of this? But first you're going to have to explain this magnetic resonator.
Yeah, so one of the most interesting projects I've gotten to do in recent years was record this piece for piano and electromagnets, which sounds like, you know, you're sticking a piano through an MRI or something. uh-huh. But I work with this really wonderful composer at the Tanglewood Music Center named Andrew McPherson, who studied electrical engineering at MIT when he was an undergrad, in addition to composition and viola. And for his, I think his graduating thesis from University of Pennsylvania in composition, on a shoestring budget, he put together this electromagnetic resonator piano. And basically what it is at the time it was 44 hand-wound electromagnets, which he was suspending from racks above the strings on the piano. And each electromagnet is wired into a hand-built amplifier, and through each electromagnet is passed a current at a frequency that corresponds to the pitch. So if it's the electromagnet above A, there would be an alternating current going at 440 cycles per second, and that on-off that pulls the string, lets the strings go 440 times per second, creates a vibration in that string. And so what you're able to do is to do things the piano can't do, which is start sounds from complete silence and crescendo, play sounds without any attack, without the hammers sounding.
You have to tune the piano to the resonators then, I assume.
He was able to tune the resonator to the piano.
Oh, really?
So every time we turned the thing on, he had to go through each resonator, and he had a little...
He's got 88 resonators?
He does now. Mm-hmm. It started as 44. He built it up over time.
Covered the whole keyboard.
The low strings took a long time to sound. They'd take, you know, up to 20 seconds before you started to hear anything. The upper strings, they'd sound almost immediately, just because the bass strings are so thick.
And what effect, then, did he want to achieve by combining these resonators with the traditional piano?
Well, the most immediate capability you have, then, is to do crescendos, which, you know, on the piano is something pianists have only ever dreamed of or tried to imitate through a sort of pianistic subterfuge. But you can actually get a crescendo, and one of the samples I pointed out to is just of that crescendos happening from total silence. And I think he found it to be a problematic project just because you're having this digital interface with an analog instrument, and that's always problematic. But it does give the piano this sort of ghostly backdrop, and the piece is so beautifully written that you often can't really tell when one is sounding and when, you know, you're just playing the traditional piano keyboard or when the resonator is...
You can't tell all you're saying.
Yeah, sometimes they blend together so well it's hard to tell them apart. Other times it's very obvious it's just the resonator because it sounds like an organ, which is a very creepy sound. It sounds just like someone's playing electronics over the piano, but it is really, truly just all completely acoustic piano sounds.
And this is from this collection that you have on a CD called Secrets of Antikythera.
Yep. And the Antikythera device, which is this device supposedly designed by Archimedes, I think, back in, you know,
BC.
A long time ago, that supposedly was able, that was discovered off the coast of Antikythera, a little island off Greece. And it was this incredible computer that was designed to chart the motion of stars and planets and way ahead of its time mathematically and computationally. And so that was the inspiration for this piece, which is largely inspired by Messiaen and the sound world of Messiaen.
A major 20th century composer.
Yeah.
So we will hear a little bit of this collection, Secrets of Antikythera. And should we start with some of that first piece from the collection?
Yeah,
given that we have just a couple of minutes.
The prologue, which is just the resonator by itself. There's no actual piano playing. I'm playing on an electric keyboard, which is moving the resonators.
So we'll just give you a little sample of what that sounds like. It's very atmospheric, to say the least. And would it be an insult to the composer, do you think, to say, wow, it makes me think of a science fiction film?
No, I think he'd probably like that. He went to MIT, so I'm sure he loves science fiction.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
Let's hear just a short, complete piece, then, now that we've gotten the sound of that resonator on its own. And now this will be the sound of the resonator as coupled with the piano.
Yeah.
From that same collection. Fair to call it a fantasy?
Yeah, I think that's an apt.
Everybody is kind of in his or her own little world listening to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no temptation to improvise there. This is every note is written down?
Every note's written down, although there is huge temptation to improvise after the recording was over. Like, just because it was sitting there turned on, I couldn't help myself.
Sure,
I had to play
sure.
with it.
Well, this is going to be quite a contrast with what you're playing tomorrow night.
Yes.
Saturday
and
night.
And also, no, there are many comparisons, atmospheric and, you know, otherworldly. Late Beethoven is very much of otherworldly kind of music.
That's true, whether you're talking piano music or string quartets or other things, too. Yes, that's true. He was considered out there.
Yeah, very much.
I think the trick would be in terms of... you know, winning a consistent audience for this, so that whole question of familiarity, because it's so much more complex. So how does a person become familiar with it enough to say, oh, I've got to go hear that again?
Right. Yeah, I know. I think often we conflate familiarity with understanding, which is totally a very normal human thing to do. You know, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't, but I often feel like it's going to take me another 50 years to understand these late Beethoven works, and a lot of contemporary music I play, I feel, is pretty easy to pick up once you get past that superficial layer of you know, this
shock.
Is totally different. It's actually quite direct underneath. Yeah. So it just depends on the music. I'll take a lifetime to figure Beethoven out, I'm sure.
Well, it's going to be some nice playing in the meantime. And I know you've gotten some really rave reviews from New York Times and other major outlets there. So... consistent with that, tomorrow night, Farley's House of Pianos, 8 o'clock, Ryan McCullough playing the last three of the 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. And thanks for sharing some insights on music old and new today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.